W233AH Monticello.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show...
Anybody know what this is? Maple candy mold. It's a bow tie. This is probably from the 1800s. These are old taps going back to the 1800s, and you can see they were making them from lead. There's lots of books here. There's also, I made these information packs that you could read a little bit before we go on the walk to.
A visit to Smokey Bell's homestead with Annie Stanley and Laura Silverman from the Outside Institute offer their curious guests a guided walk in the late winter woods, coming up on Farm and Country after news headlines.
March 23rd, 2024.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The Senate passed a $1.2 trillion government spending package early this morning, a couple of hours after the midnight deadline. Action on a regular funding package was more than 6 months overdue, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer was relieved.
It is good for the American people that we have reached a bipartisan agreement to complete the job of funding the government.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports that Israel has accused a dozen agency employees of helping with the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel that killed 1,200 people.
The U.S. bill includes a one-year ban on funding to UNRWA. 13,000 employees in Gaza. But 14 countries froze funding back in January. Only a few have recently restored it. The U.S. will now redirect its share of aid to other groups working with Palestinians. Israel's government welcomed the move. Critics warn of disastrous consequences, as experts say people in Gaza face imminent famine. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
11 people have been apprehended by Russian authorities after a terror attack on a crowded concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow. At least 133 people were killed. The Afghanistan branch of the Islamic State is claiming responsibility. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin is suggesting that Ukraine was linked to the attack, charging that four of the apprehended attackers were taken into custody near the Ukraine border. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford tells us Ukraine calls the charge absurd.
This statement said that the suspects, those suspected of carrying out this attack on the Krokus City Mall in Moscow, had then fled the scene and that they were heading towards Ukraine. Now, I've just spoken to a spokesperson for military intelligence here in Ukraine, and he has called that absolutely absurd. He made the point quite clearly that that area is absolutely full of security services, full of military at the moment. There is an active front line in that area. And he said that to suggest that terrorists fleeing a terrorist attack would head to specifically that region would suggest they were either idiots or suicidals.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford. Russia yesterday unleashed aerial attacks over Ukraine targeting electrical facilities across several cities. Many Ukrainians were in darkness. This is NPR News.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm your host, Rosie Starr. On today's show, Smokey Bell's homesteader Annie Stanley and Laura Silverman from the Outside Institute offer their curious guests a guided walk in the late winter woods to observe maple trees tapped for fresh syrup. It was a holistic experience that acknowledged the history of the Lenape people who lived along the Delaware River Valley. Annie displayed a table of reading material with antique tools, and together with Laura, they identified various species and offered tastings of sweet samples and a warm lunch by a campfire. Thank you for joining us on Radio Catskill for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
My name is Nancy. I live in Southern Wayne County in Sterling Township, Pennsylvania. And I follow the Outdoor Institute and Laura on Instagram. And I saw the post come up for this event. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have to go do this. This sounds like a great way to spend the afternoon.
Well, it's the first time that you've been to the homestead at Smoky Bell's?
Yes, first time. I didn't even know it existed here. So I Googled it and did the research and just read some amazing things about it. So I was so excited.
Well, it's quite an idyllic day. The sun is just streaming through these evergreen trees. There's snow on the ground. There's a fire going, standing in a like little rolling hills of moss. But you just tasted Annie's fresh tapped maple water. And your reaction was beautiful. Tell me.
Thank you. I was a little surprised at first because I just thought it would be sweet because you think maple syrup. It was refreshing. It was different. Like just a little hint of a little sweetness. It reminded me of like a vanilla soda or a vanilla cream soda when I was a kid. It was amazing. And it's clear. It looks exactly like water, which again, I was surprised about. So special that 24 hours ago, this tree water was in the tree. And now we're getting to enjoy that. Not everybody can do that. It would be lovely if everyone could experience that.
I agree. And it's because of Annie. She lives the philosophy of homesteading here and knows all the ways in which to tap. And she keeps it historically relevant and natural.
This is her whole life. It's wonderful and hard, hard work. And she obviously loves it or she wouldn't be here.
Here we are in the Delaware River Valley. It's adjacent to the 10 Mile River, and the property is just humming with local people or visitors that have come to experience this day with Annie and Laura Silverman. You could hear the chirping in the background. There's lots to learn today, so Laura's amongst us now. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Welcome, everybody. I'm Laura, founder of the Outside Institute. And we are on the amazing property of Annie Stanley, who has Smoky Bell's Homestead. A lot of people were asking, like, what is this place? It's a magical place that consists of Annie's home, which is over there. That's where the sap evaporator is. So part of our walk is going to be headed over in that direction. And this is a rental property that she has, which also houses queer artist residencies and... This is the Writer Shack. We have the new edition of the outhouse back there, which is actually really lovely. If you haven't been, I recommend it. It's got an amazing seat. It's a really beautiful spot because right across the road over that way is the 10 Mile River, which flows into the Delaware and gets quite mighty after lots of rain. And there's really beautiful trees around here. We saw an eagle this morning flying over, and it's a really special spot. It attracts a lot of really incredible people, and Annie is pretty, she's the captain and is known by all. Her aesthetic is without peer. You'll take it in, I'm sure, and all the little details around here. It's always amazing to be outside in winter when the sun is shining, and I think you can probably already feel how the light has shifted, and we can feel spring on its way, and it certainly is expressed overtly in the flowing of the sap. It's a sure sign that they're getting ready to make leaves again, because when they make leaves, they are harnessing the energy of the sun through photosynthesis to feed themselves, and the whole cycle starts up again. We'll talk about trees and identifying trees in winter when there's no leaves, how you'll know to recognize a maple on your property if you have it. The fact that you can tap other trees besides maples, you can tap birch trees, you can tap sycamore. All of these trees have sap that flows. I think the sap starts flowing in the maples first, and the maple sap is perhaps the sweetest. And then we're going to go and, like I said, look at the evaporator, which is kind of like a bigger way to boil down the sap. What's really cool about Annie, like I said, she has this very vintage slash antique aesthetic. And so you don't come here and expect to see a lot of rubber and plastic. In fact, you won't see any. So she does it old school, and it's super intriguing to see how it's done. One thing that I always wondered was how you know how deep to drive the spike in, because I'm always really paranoid about hurting the tree. So she's going to address that. All right, everybody, follow.
All right, let's go.
All right. Follow the woman in the pink shirt. She knows everything.
That had such fun.
Okay. Where is the woman?
Right here.
Yeah.
This is Laura.
Everybody gather around. Look at the crazy mushrooms on here, too. The fungus. So these walks are fairly slow paced. If you've never been on one of my walks before, we kind of stop and take a look at a lot of different things. But one thing I wanted to point out to you, since we're talking about trees today and identifying trees by the bark, which is a winter practice, does anyone recognize this tree?
Yeah.
This is an ash tree.
Oh, yes.
So the ash trees in this area have fallen under the spell of the emerald ash borer beetle, which lays its eggs underneath the bark and ultimately kills the tree. So most of the ashes in this area are either moribund or dead already. A lot of people are always asking me, should I take these ash trees down? What's the answer, Annie?
Well, you do it selectively, because dead trees are actually a great habitat for a lot of insects and animals. If you do take it down, then you better use it for firewood. I wouldn't just take it down for nothing.
Good answer. The bark of the ash tree has a deeply furrowed diamond pattern. When the beetle starts to get it, it sloughs the bark off and it gets this very flat, rectangular look instead. So you might not be able to recognize it in the same way.
This is my favorite friend, this time besides my dog. It's great to have a sled like this. When there's snow, I can transport the 5-gallon buckets of sap back to my house. So that's why the sled is there.
What's this little stand of trees right here? What?
Are they the birch trees?
What's old about them? Okay, so it's a different kind of birch. These are black birches.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, how did you know it was a birch? That's right. So it has little horizontal lines, lenticels. That's how the tree breathes. It exchanges gases through those little lines. But also another telltale about birches is the way they crack. So even in these relatively small trees, you can see there's horizontal lines but vertical cracking. So you probably know like the millennial birch logs with the peely white bark, right? So all birches peel for the most part, but this one peels in a very, like, subtle way with these vertical cracks. This is another tree that's really good to tap, because the sap of black birch is also called sweet birch or cherry birch. So it has very delicious sap that you can also boil down. But drinking the sap fresh is really amazing from a birch.
That's what they used to make root beer out of. And you can, yeah, you can make soda water out of it. It's also delicious. The birch tapping season happens after the maple season, so it'll be later, like more into, you know, late March, early April.
And then just another thing to be noticing on this walk is the incredible mosses that are here. And just so that you can observe it, not only for its incredible beauty, but also if you get a little bit closer to it, its texture, and you'll start to see that what you think of as one moss covering a rock turns out to be 8 or 9 different varieties if you look a little bit closer.
And it takes many, many years for this to establish.
Right.
So I always try to avoid walking on it when I'm going in the woods.
It's very resilient, but what you shouldn't be doing is like pulling up handfuls of it. What's the difference between lichen and moss? People often mistake lichen for moss because it's green and it's kind of creeping along on different surfaces. But lichen is actually completely separate. It's its own organism. It's actually two organisms living in symbiosis. It's an algae and a fungus. They're basically exchanging nutrients of different kinds, right? Because the fungus doesn't photosynthesize and the algae does. So they're just having this like harmonious hangout that's called lichen. And they're very, very, very slow growing, and they're super ancient. They've been around on Earth probably since the very beginning. In the same way that they're growing on rock, they're growing on the tree. You can see it. This is lichen as well.
So get a little closer. Ideally, you don't want to tap trees that are less than 8-inch diameter. My forest is pretty young here because I had, you know, there was a lot of logging back in the logging days, and they're bringing all the logs down to build New York City and Philadelphia. This area was heavily logged. This is a red maple. I have more red maple than sugar maple on my property. It's got a smoother bark, but as this tree gets older, it will create more of a rough bark like this pattern. It's always a vertical pattern in the bark. It's not like as petite as the ash. The sugar maple has a much rougher bark, and there's also a silver maple. It's kind of tricky. It took me several years to really try to identify these trees, but sometimes I tap the wrong tree. If you look up, though, you can see that opposite branching we were talking about, and you can pass the binoculars around if anybody needs. You see how there's the main branch, and then it's opposite. If you really have a hard time, you can always, in the fall, identify the trees and put a ribbon on them. Then you can see the leaves. It's usually the sugar maple, I think, has 5 lobes in the shape. We all know what that maple leaf looks like. So, and I also, you know, I do a rotation. I don't want to tap a tree too much over the years. You don't want to put too many holes in it. If you drill too deep into the tree when you're tapping, that could hurt it. You're also supposed to go around the tree from the prior year, like a foot over and 6 inches up or down. You don't want to tap a tree where there's like some damage already there. You want to find a healthy place, and you want to be, you know, about 4 or 5 feet off the ground. This is a power drill. I'm cheating. You want to drill at a slight angle so then it helps it flow out of the tree. Like I said, you want to go in like only 1.5 to 2 inches. I'm using a smaller tap. This is a more modern one. I'm only going to go about 1.5 inches. You really just want to get past that layer of bark. On a younger tree, it's not that deep. So here we go. Bless the tree. All right, I didn't bring my little tool, so I'm just going to blow it up. You want to get that debris out of there. You can put a piece of tape, you know, you can measure and put a piece of red tape or mark a red, you know, marker line on there so you know how deep. I know my drill bit's about 1.5 inches to there. This is a spade bit, which works better than otherwise. And another tool, ye old hammer. You got to remember to put your hook on the tap before you pound it into the tree. So there you go. You don't want to whack it because that it will end up cracking the tree, you know. So that's that. I usually say tap, 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 and that's enough.
So then you just hook the bucket on there. It's not coming out of the tree. It's a little chilly today, but sometimes when I do this, it's like flowing out right away. Above 35, so not freezing. Really sunny days, but cold nights. And that, it kind of makes the tree contract and expand. And basically what, you know, is the tree is pulling the sap from the roots and sending it all the way up to the buds. And that's what we're tapping into. Then you just, there's a little thing here. You put that through the tap thing. And this keeps out debris and rain, and that's it. This is like homesteading 101, very easy, until you have to haul it all out of the woods by yourself.
But how about bears? Do bears want to...
I've always wondered that. I've woken up in the middle of the night and imagined a bear, like, taking the bucket. You know, if I was a bear, I would probably do that. But there are other animals. That's the sign that, you know, the sap is flowing, actually, because the red squirrels will chew on the bark, and we might see that somewhere. Also, the sapsucker woodpecker. If you hear them knocking in the woods, and you'll see them on the maples, and they're actually, like, getting the sap.
Actually, what they're doing is they're drilling a series of holes. So you've probably seen that in trees before, lines of holes. That's how the sapsucker drills in. And then it goes away, and it waits for the sap to fill in the holes, and then it comes back and it drinks it. It has a very long tongue. And then I read, because Annie was like, you got to read up on maple stuff before you come. So I did read that... lots of other animals come and drink out of the sapsucker holes, not just the sapsucker itself. So, like, lots of other critters are getting in on that. I don't know. They don't have the long tongue of the sapsucker, how they're doing it, but I guess they're sucking on the tree.
Why the pioneers started tapping trees is because the Native Americans taught them how to do it. Because England had cut off the sugar importing in the Boston Harbor, and there was no sugar. It was a big crisis, so the Native Americans taught the settlers how to make maple syrup, and they were making blocks of it, of candy, and curing their meat. It became medicinal to drink the sap, and they were rubbing it on their eyes because their cabins were so smoky. It was multi-purpose, the Native Americans. We're tapping trees forever.
For those of you that don't know, we are on the lands of the Lenape people, who were here for many thousands of years before the colonists came. And most of the knowledge that we've just shared with you is directly from those people. I have this greetings to the natural world that indigenous peoples generally recite at the beginning of every gathering. We're just going to quickly do that together. Today we have gathered and we see that the cycles of life continue. We have been given the duty to live in balance and harmony with each other and all living things. So now we bring our minds together as one, as we give greetings and thanks to each other as people. Now our minds are one.
So we can carry on. I'm boiling sap down at my house on an evaporator if somebody wants to see the setup. We can meander over there.
Yeah, let's check out the evaporator, and then we'll have even more of an appetite for lunch.
This is an evaporator. So you can put this over a fire pit and do a large quantity at the same time. While I have this quite full, then I can keep adding up to it. And you have to time it right, because if you start cooking this in the evening, then you're going to have to stay up all night long. And I did that to myself a couple times. So you want to try to start it in the morning, and then... it'll be, you know, it could be like a 10-12 hour ordeal to boil this down to
And you can stop it when you feel like you have the right consistency that you want. There's a temperature gauge on here. You want it to be boiling like at 250, you know, the whole time. And the longer you boil it, the darker it will get. But I also tend to find, like, this is also true of honey. I find, like, the honey that you get later in the season is always darker. And it's because of whatever the bees are eating. And I find that to be true with maple syrup, too. At the end of the season, or maybe it's just because I get lazier and I let it boil longer and I'm not so excited about it, then it ends up being darker. But then when you're ready and you think it's done, then I tap it out here into a pot and I finish it off on my stove or your wood stove. The last 2 hours are pretty crucial. You could easily make an accidental candy batch or burn your pot, which I have done many times. Or you can get a big pot like this and get like an outdoor cooker thing. But I usually finish off on my stove in the house, and so then I can really keep an eye on it. But this is, you know, it's a pretty simple setup.
How do you know when it's done?
Well, you can take a spoon very simply and like let it drip, and you see that viscosity of it, like maple syrup. You can also, there's like a candy thermometer that you can use. I just do it by eye. If a batch comes out thinner, then you just use that for cooking or cocktails. So, yeah, it's all up to everyone's personal taste. There's no rules, really, but the maple syrup that you buy in the store, they actually add corn syrup to it. It's pretty gross. This is nothing added to it. It's like the real deal, and you will taste that. I'm going to grab a jar of mine from the house, and I'll bring it back, and we can all taste my own. There's a chart down there on the table, on the education table, that explains about the different grades. Unlike honey, you have to keep maple syrup refrigerated once you open it. It will go sour. And the same with the sap. Like if you don't keep the sap water chilled, that can also go sour. I've had a couple of jars crystallize. It has a pretty good shelf life. Like I think you can keep it for about a year, even if it's not pasteurized. You could freeze it if you want to drink the sap water. I don't clean any of my equipment or the mason jars or anything with soap. I just use vinegar and water. The pot that you use to boil, you shouldn't use any soap because you will potentially taste that residue. Even at the end of the season, I just throw these in a bucket of vinegar to clean them up and put them in storage. So thanks everybody for coming down.
Annie and Laura walked back with their guest to enjoy a warm lunch of chili stews while sitting around a campfire. We hope that you enjoyed our show this week with production by a Radio Catskill volunteer. Special thanks goes to our guests, Annie Stanley from Smoky Bell's Homestead and Laura Silverman from the Outside Institute. This has been your host, Rosie Starr. Thanks for listening local to Farm and Country and supporting Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Listen on air at 90.5 FM on your phone or smart speaker and online at wjffradio.org. Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.
Hey, it's Steve Inske.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe.
One of the things you can count on from NPR and this station, we've got your back. when it comes to reporting the news, bringing you facts you can count on. You can help by donating a vehicle you no longer need.
That car could be worth hundreds of dollars in support or more as a donation.
Think about it.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at wjffradio.org.
Former President Trump is in real legal trouble, facing multiple